Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. British literary superstar Martin Amis has been the novelist the English love to hate, to haunt, to ogle. Son of the famed writer Kingsley Amis, bad boy, playboy, and snob in the London tabloids. For Martin Amis, writes The Observer, publication day for a new novel is a carnivorous and gleeful public carnival. The bastards, reviewers, all want your guts for garters. Some days they've had them, some days they haven't. His latest novel, House of Meetings, the story of a heartbreaking love triangle played out in a Soviet slave labor camp, is getting hosannas. And Amis is still at full sail on Islam, America, feminism, snobbery. Up next on Point, a conversation with the unflinching novelist Martin Amis. I'm joined in the studio by Martin Amis. He's the best-selling author of, among others, Time's Arrow, London Fields, and Money. His latest novel is House of Meetings. The New York Times calls it a bullet train of a novel that barrels deep into the heart of darkness. The Economist calls it a singular, unimpeachable triumph. Martin Amis, no guts for garters this time. Congratulations. Good reception.
Thank you very much.
I wish you'd help us to begin to wade into your narrative here with a little description of the House of Meetings, what it is and the role it plays in the story you tell of Soviet-era slave labor.
It's a sort of ridiculous and tragic thing that as part of the Bolshevik progressivist ideas about society, there were conjugal visits in the gulag. These visits, you know, valiant young women or not so young women would travel for weeks and sometimes months just, you know, up beyond the Arctic Circle to spend a night with their husbands.
One night,
sometimes more. Mm-hmm. And these meetings were nearly always tragic, for various reasons.
Among them, these were often broken men.
Broken men and broken marriages. And also when they came out, you know, the House of Meetings was also, by definition, a house of partings. And if you had some comfort together, to leave your wife and then re-enter the slave system was often more traumatic than your initiation into that system. And my novel revolves on such a meeting, such a night in the gulag.
And in this case, all the more complex because there's a love triangle around this and a love triangle with two brothers at two corners of the triangle, Lev and his brother, the narrator of the book, and the great beauty Zoya, who they've both loved, the younger brother. Lev will have her on this night in the cabin outside the camp. The other will grind his teeth. They've both been in the gulag for years by the time she shows up. Love and slave labor camps are an unusual combination.
Yeah, well, I read about it. It's mentioned in Solzhenitsyn. I read about it. Anne Applebaum in her book Gulag has three or four pages on it. And it is, as you say, a violent collision of themes. But that's the sort of thing I like. And I knew when I just read these few pages that I could write, would be hard, but I could write a novel about it.
Mm. But right inside the fence, away from the cabin, is this horrible gulag. You write about it in a fresh way. I wonder if you could read just a bit for us, Martin Amis, from House of Meetings. There's a bit starts on page 27, that describes the social structure of the gulag. Here, what is it, the 69th parallel, you write, north of the Arctic Circle, your imagined place. Was it Norlag, I believe, was the name of this camp, as you share it? You write about the society inside.
Right. This was how power was distributed in our animal farm. At the top were the pigs, the janitoriat of administrators and guards. Next came the irkas. Designated as socially friendly elements, they had the status of trustees who, moreover, did no work. Beneath the Urkas were the snakes, the informers, the one in tans. And beneath the snakes were the leeches, bourgeois fraudsters, counterfeiters and embezzlers and the like. Close to the bottom of the pyramid came the fascists, the counters, the 58ers, the enemies of the people, the politicals. Then you got the locusts, the juveniles, the little Calibans, byblows of revolution, displacement and terror. They were the feral orphans of the Soviet experiment. Without their nonsensical laws and protocols, the Urkas would have been just like the locusts, only bigger. The locusts had no norms at all. Finally, right down there in the dust were the Drek-eaters, the goners, the wicks. They couldn't work anymore, and they could no longer bear the pains of hunger, so they feebly brawled over the slops and the garbage. Like my brother, I was a socially hostile element, a political, a fascist. Needless to say, I was not a fascist, I was a communist. And a communist I remained until the early afternoon of August the 1st, 1956. There were also animals, real animals, in our animal farm. Dogs.
Martin Amis, reading from his new novel, House of Meetings. I wish you'd take us back to some of the history of this time. It's the post-World War II 1940s, when first one brother and then the next are swept up into this camp. It's 1956 by the time of the fateful conjugal visit. What are the politics framing the gulag at that point?
It's not widely understood what the gulag was. You hear people say Guantanamo Bay is our gulag, mm-hmm. is America's gulag. Mm-hmm. No, it's not. The gulag was a slave system, a slave empire. It was one of its functions was to keep everyone terrified, but the NKVD was doing that.
Secret Service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was... people were arrested by quota, I want 2,000 prisoners from this area, you'd say, and that's your minimum, and you do make the arrests. The narrator, for instance, doesn't even mention why he's there, because it's irrelevant. And even the terror was done that way by quotas and norms.
Though he's in the category of fascist, which, as he says, doesn't mean fascist at all. He fought in the war against fascists. He's simply a, for one reason or another, considered a political dissident.
That's right. Yes, he fought in the war against fascism and then was accused of being fascist by a Soviet government which was itself fascist at that time. Soviet Union went fascist after the war for the remaining 8 years of Stalin's life, by which I mean a great emphasis on the folk, the great Russians, at the expense of the Georgians, and etc., and xenophobia, which takes its usual form of anti-Semitism. And Zoya is Jewish. And
the great beauty, the love of both the men.
And so, while her husband, the younger brother, is in the gulag, he's terrified that Zoya is going to be, beaten to death in the street. The slave system and the anti-Semitism were abandoned within days of Stalin's death. And the great paradox and humiliation of the gulag was that Stalin thought it made money. Everyone else knew it didn't make money. Mm. Beria knew, Khrushchev knew. Mm. But no one dared tell Stalin. Mm. And so the minute he died, they were wrenching the barracks apart. It limped on into Gorbachev's era, but the slave idea was gone.
You pose your narrator as, in his own words, an old Russian coming home, a man in his high 80s going back to visit the site of that camp and that cabin. I mean, and by this point, he's had a great a whole life on the other side of the gulag, became an arms trader eventually, a lot of interaction with Zoya and others after the camp. His daughter, as I read you, lives in America, maybe near Chicago somewhere. He's trying to explain to her what went on here. But it's a long time ago in his life and in ours. I mean, the gulag at this point almost seems like a mildly anachronistic as a subject for a novel. What took you back to it?
I think it's anachronistic because it belongs in the past. But like all historical events, it's only anachronistic in that sense. Mm. It's... you don't write a novel for pro bono reasons, but the great Borgesian infinite library of the Holocaust. We all know that, you know, it's endless, infinite, and so it should be. But the Gulag, I think, is very under-remembered and under-honored. And, you know, having written the book, I thought, if I can awaken anyone to, you know, have a tender thoughts about these victims, then that's an unarguable gain.
It's a love story, a love triangle, and with politics shot all through it. So where do you see the rudder, in love or in politics, or are they inseparable?
Well, there's one point where the older brother, who's a war veteran, unlike his brother, who is younger, is trying to make Zoya his girlfriend, and he almost says to her, "Listen, you're Jewish. If you become my lover, this will protect you, because war veterans had enormous prestige, especially if they'd been on the front line and especially if they'd been wounded." And he says, you know, it's humiliating to have these thoughts, but this is the real result of state systems, you know, that they get into your private life, into your most intimate areas of your life, are determined by the state.
Martin Amis, there's a passage which takes us into the older brother's heart and mind. His younger brother has captured the love of his life, Zoya, but he can't get her out of his mind. In fact, he has a kind of gulag slave camp ritual when he goes to sleep at night that you share. I wish you'd read it for us.
Sure. When he first finds out about Zoya, he behaves quite well about it, and he claims that this is because he's in shock. And when the shock wears off, he said, "I got much worse." Right. I said earlier that I was in shock about Zoya, and that's true. It lasted until the day the sun came up. You could just see the corona, a pearly liquid smeared on the tundra's edge. The long eclipse was over. Fingers pointed, and there was a grumbling, burbly cheer from the men. And I, too, came up out of eclipse and obscuration. I was no longer muffled in the chemicals of calm. Now I started to look at my losses, and they were serious. I realized that there was nothing now, nothing at all, that I liked to think about. Many more or less regrettable peccadilloes in camp were widely practiced, but onanism wasn't one of them. The Yerkers did it, and in public, and I suppose the younger rustics managed it for a while. For the rest of us, it became a part of the past. Yet we all had the thoughts. I think we all still had the thoughts. I still had them. Every night, I staged my experiment. I would enter a room where Zoya lay sleeping. It was late afternoon. She was on the bed, among star-bright pillows, in a petticoat or a short nightdress. Here and here only, some variation was allowed. I sat beside her and took her hand in mine. I kissed her lips. Then came the moment of transformation when she rose up, flowed up into my arms, and it began. This nightly Fata Morgana used to feel like a source of strength, a reconnection with vital powers. But now it was weakening me and corroding me, and as the sun worked its way up over the horizon, I started saying it to myself, at first in a whisper of insomnia, then out loud in daylight, I started saying it. They didn't mean to do this, but that's what they've done. They've attacked my will, and that's all I've got.
Martin Amis, reading from his new novel, House of Meetings, where the gulag prisoner has even his dreams taken over, diminished by what goes on around him. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let me go to Michael, calling from Winchester, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air with Martin Amis.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Fine, how are you?
I have a question for Mr. Amis. I'm a fan of yours, and the question I have is relating to other writers of your stature and why they don't attack large and deeply historical themes the way that you do, like Saul Bellow has done, and in a particular favorite of mine is Robert Stone. And I'm very disappointed at the level of, I guess, conversation that the novel has not reached, except in a few cases such as yours.
Well, I think novelists do visit the past, Ian McEwan in Atonement, and you can't really decide to take on these themes. It's not that way round. I mean, I agree with you that the novel should be able to take these things on, but you can't oblige a writer to do it.
But do you agree with Michael that they're not doing it? I mean, Philip Roth was going back recently. We've just taped on this show an interview with Norman Mailer. We'll air it tomorrow. He's talking about Adolf Hitler's earliest years. It's hardly ducking hard history there.
No. I mean, but if you ask any of those writers, they'll say that it wasn't a kind of executive decision to go back and look at those things. It's because something burrowed into their unconscious minds, and they had what Nabokov calls that little throb where you know you're going to head in a certain direction.
Michael, what keeps you coming back to Martin Amis's work?
The ambition and the success of his books. The same thing that I would look at with Saul Bellow and Robert Stone, and I don't want to badmouth anyone. But I see it in poetry as well, but that'd be a long story.
Saul Bellow, a great hero of Martin Amis's. Michael, thanks for your call. Remind us of your admiration, relationship with the late Saul Bellow.
Yes, well, we passed his street on the way here.
You lived for years in Boston after his Chicago years, of course, yeah?
That's right. And in fact, one of my most prized possessions is Saul's leather jacket, and the leather jacket seemed to hum and warm up as we entered the precincts of Boston, just as it did when we entered the precincts of Chicago recently. I think unquestionably the greatest American writer of all time, and I loved his work, and I loved him, too.
Paul is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with Martin Amis.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody else. I just wanted to make a small comment. I've been in the United States for 16 years, and I was born and raised in a dictatorial communist regime in Albania.
Mm.
And I wanted to say about the book, the guy did a good thing about that book, but it's a very, very polished for a book, and it got Love Triangle, but it's extremely harsh and grim reality on those regimes, and that should be a lesson for us. I'm a U.S. citizen at this point, and that should be a lesson for us. And I'm a Republican, and I didn't vote last time for Republican, and that I was one of the vote that lost the Congress, and I did good things because...
What's the lesson you're taking these days, Paul? What's the lesson from that harshness?
The lesson is America has to protect hard those freedom and liberties that we got here and not to lose it to one side or to the other side. And that's one of the lessons that the American people have to get from that book, and that's the reality of that book. It's a wonderful thing to learn about those past and never forget so we don't go back.
Martin Amis, here's Paul, an Albanian-American, saying don't forget, the danger's there.
Yes, I know, and many of us feel at the moment that that our freedoms are under threat and being whittled away at. And I've talked to older people who say, you know, who've been through the Second World War, and they say, you're letting your freedom slip through your fingers. Freedom is not the natural, God-given condition of mankind. It's something we have to strive for and jealously guard.
Paul, thanks for your call. Martin Amis has a wonderfully Martin Amis-style passage here where the older brother stumbles on his younger brother being brought into the camp, is dismayed. They finally get a chance to speak. They don't want to let anyone know their brothers because that can be a target of torment. But he asks, you know, what did you come in for? What were you brought in for? What charge? As you say, it could be random. He says, praising America. And then you describe these different varieties of praising America that could lead one into the gulag, praising American democracy or praising American technique or abasement before America. In fact, he's talking about something quite different, and here's your twist. Explain it for us.
And the older brother says, and were you praising America? And he says, no, I was praising the Americas, because the Americas is their
sort of
family
code word,
name,
yes.
Code name for Zoya. And she's called that because she has a very full figure, but also a wasp waist.
You have to sort of figure the sand clock figure of Zoya looking like North and South America with Panama in the middle.
That's right. And so Brazil is her sort of backside, and California is her chest. But also you know, it's unaligned. It's not aligned very exactly on the globe. There's a disjunction there.
It's moving.
And that's because she, for all her beauty, she's not steady on her feet because as a child, as a baby, she never learned how to crawl. And so certain reflexes aren't there. And she's a sort of big, clumsy beauty. And the Americas is what she looks like.
America sits in the background here, and you spent a lot of time in the United States. But, of course, it's in Russia, above all, the high 80s returnee feels himself Russifying all over again, becoming Eastern. And you write that he says, keep a lookout for other national traits, that is, of the Russian, the freedom from all responsibility and scruple, the energetic companionship of views and beliefs that are not only irreconcilable but also mutually exclusive, the weakness for a humor of squalor and cynicism, the tendency to speak most passionately when being most insincere, the thirst for abstract argument at unlikely moments, say in the middle of a prison stampede, and it goes on, for example, at the climax of a cholera riot. Are you... I don't know. Is this Martin Amis speaking? Is this your deeply sour view of the Russian?
Yes, it's my model novel for this novel is Conrad Under Western Eyes, and he has many brilliant passages where he says it's no good looking at Russia with Western eyes. You're going to miss its essence. You have to use Eastern eyes, and that's. My character finds that his eyes, after 20 years in Chicago, have become Western, but very quickly reverts to the Asiatic vision. Russia has never really decided whether it's European or Asiatic, and it's an unholy brew of those two traits.
But does Asiatic necessarily mean being all these kind of despicable things that you describe here? Really?
Well, yes, it does, really. It's...
It's kind of a London view of things, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you don't say one thing is better than the other, morally, society, but you do say one is more evolved than the other. Now think, in America 150 years ago, Americans were facing each other with rifles and shooting each other and stabbing each other and scalping each other. And you've moved on from there. You've accumulated moral wealth, and you do it... not by being intrinsically better, but by being more evolved. And Europe is more evolved than Asia, and it's pointless to deny that fact.
Robert is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air with Martin Amis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question for Mr. Amis is basically about source material, about the Gulag system, and whether or not he is familiar with the book Without Vodka by Alexander Topolsky.
I'm not familiar with that book.
Okay, well, the saying, without vodka, comes from a saying, I guess, in the Gulag system. It's a first-hand account of a young Polish teenager who was taken into the Gulag system at the beginning of World War II, and a phrase commonly said by the those in the system was that without vodka, it was impossible to understand the sort of madness behind the Russian system.
Yes, the phrase I use is the centuries-old momentum of Russian drunkenness. Another theme of this book is the fact that Russia demographically is dying, literally. It's losing population at a rate of about 900,000 a year, and they project that by the year 2050, the population will have halved. A Russian man is nine times more likely to die violently than an Israeli man. And it's drunkenness, lousy health system, a kind of... impetuosity in the Russian nature, and the death rate is climbing while the birth rate falls, and they crossed in, I think, 1992, and the gap is widening every day.
Robert, thanks for your call. So what's the conversation between these cultures? It's very intimate in your book. You've got the high 80s, the 80-something narrator, writing sort of like the Ancient Mariner to his young daughter who lives in the West, again, in the United States.
Stepdaughter,
excuse me.
And I didn't make it sufficiently clear because I didn't want to spell it out. It seemed vulgar, but she's also a black American. So when he says to her early on that he's going to confess to some terrible things, but he doesn't think she's going to excommunicate him from her memory or her affections, for this reason, because she understands what it is to be a slave. In her blood, she understands. Sorry, go on.
And he had been.
Yeah.
So perhaps she has that unique insight, but he also, it seems to me, treats her through the book as your sort of archetypal, practically American at this point. He's very aware that she's going to have trouble, or may, having understanding where he's coming from, having been through all this. What is that conversation between these cultures, continents?
Well, he's saying to her, he teases her that she's ideological, and he has good reason to fear ideologies. She has the modern ideology, which is, you know, there are a million names for it: relativism, multiculturalism, political correctness, levelism, Westernism, etc. Westernism is the one I choose. And he's saying it's no good transporting these values to the sort of events I'm going to talk about, because that really is anachronistic. You have to apply. He's asking her to apply her historical imagination and not to exercise zero tolerance, which is a policy for those who want zero thought.
And the lesson that this ancient mariner brings to his stepdaughter in his late 80s, what's he most trying to convey to her across all that span of time and different environment, different culture?
I think he and I want to get to the closer to understanding the Russian curse, the Russian perversity. This novel was really born in me in my scowling, nihilistic teen years. When I was about 17, I read a very great deal of Dostoevsky, because he's very good when you're full of that lassitude and disgust, you know, the kaffir of late adolescence. And he understood it. And I want to understand it more, you know. And the explanation you end up with is that if you have a people who, in their thousand-year history, have never had any freedom, and then they also have no moral responsibility. And this lack of freedom makes them anarchical in their own hearts and souls. And this is why they always do the worst possible thing. It's always the worst possible outcome.
But maybe a lesson for everyone as well. As I read you know, Americans like to say these days, whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Him saying, well, no, actually. What hurts you deeply may simply hurt you, may leave you weaker.
What doesn't kill you makes you weaker and kills you later on.
Martin Amis is in the studio with me, and we have a call right now from, no less, Moscow, Russia. Kate's on the line. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Kate, how on earth are you? How on earth are you hearing us there?
On Armed Forces Network.
Terrific. What do you say, Kate?
Yes, I just wondered if you could speak briefly about how your novel relates to the Russians' regard for human life, the value of human life, as it relates to the past and perhaps even the present.
Sure. Well, I'll try. The value of human life in Russia is low, and it's always seemed to me that the state has never cared about its citizens. That isn't its concern. Its concern is to be a great power, and we can see Putin now has his head down as he heads towards great powerdom. This is what he's interested in. The explanation some historians give for this statist ideology, where everything serves the state, is geographical. They say that the vastness of Russia is such that in some way it overthrows the sanity of those who rule it. With these continental-sized borders, this land that's been conquered in a paranoid spirit to keep people away, so to speak. And it's like the physics of a galaxy, that you need the black holes in the center and the dark energy and the dark matter to police that tug to the center. Otherwise, the whole thing will just fly apart. And that's why it always seems to head in the authoritarian direction.
Kate, you're in Moscow. Does that sound right to you?
Well, I do read in the Moscow Times, frankly, something rather morbid. Every week there's a list of bodies found in Russia, which always sort of shocks me. And it's in the 70 to 80 numbers, and it's always sort of shocking. You know, there's not really equivalent to that, I think, in the United States. So, I mean, it's obviously Moscow's a large city, so there's going to be things like that. But
you mean 70 or 80 bodies in Moscow itself?
Right.
That's a few. I have to say, it's no paradise here, but that's a big number. That's a big number.
Well, I mean, it's just it's sort of a grim reality, I think, of the big city. But it's been a question that's been on my mind, and I look forward to the book, Mr. Amos. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kate, thanks for calling from Moscow. Martin Amos, you know, one of the things when we listen to British writers is, not that there aren't plenty of bold American writers, but there's a kind of boldness in the way you throw this stuff out there. Have you traveled to Russia? And what on earth do Russians say back to you when you deliver these, sweeping definitions of their national character?
Well, I've never been to Russia. I've never set foot in it. And I didn't want to go just before writing this because I wanted to keep it a kind of a pure Russia of the imagination. I'm assuming I am published rather fitfully in Russia, and I'm assuming this book will appear there. And I wonder if the publisher is perhaps a little worried that he's going to get a shot of polonium 210.
The umbrella tip.
Yeah, because Russia's got the kind of Turkish disease now, it seems, where you're punished for speaking ill of Russia, insulting Russianness. And I can imagine the state becoming, more and more Stalinist in this sense, that incredibly touchy about the image of Russia abroad, while at the same time, murdering dissident ex-secret policemen like Litvinenko, with a substance that could only be found in a state laboratory. Now, if that's not just an incompetent murder, a screwed-up murder, then it's an amazingly aggressive statement by the government that, yes, we're going to get you, and we don't care who knows.
Help us understand the cultural geography of Martin Amos these days. The British papers are full of your... You've got celebrity status there on many fronts, and your Long Island home and your Uruguay home and your American-Uruguayan heiress wife. Where do you live? Where's your geographic cultural center these days?
London. We were in Uruguay for 2.5 years, and
wrote this book by a pool in Uruguay, or struggled to. I
did.
Read
yeah,
that's a stretch.
Well, yes,
69th parallel. Be damned.
It was somewhat embarrassing to be writing it in subtropical peace and harmony, with the sea lapping at the garden gate. But I had to pay a price for that, and the price was almost a year of terrible struggle with this book. I've never struggled.
To pull up the gulag at poolside?
It was... I can now see in retrospect what it was, and it was a struggle for legitimacy. And the only way I could win that was by having a terrible time. And I couldn't do it in penal servitude above the Arctic Circle. I could only do the suffering of the study, and every writer knows what that is. Mm. I didn't sit there weeping for the victims of Stalin, although there would be, occasional moments of great pity for them. But every morning I'd go in, and it was like starting from scratch, and it was as if my unconscious mind was not plugged in and wasn't helping me at all.
To trudge back to the gulag, back to the snow.
That's right. And that went on almost till I'd finished the thing, and then I sort of hit bottom, and I realized I'd ceased to think of myself as a writer. I thought, that's all gone. And then the next day, I began to feel all right. Then when the proofs came, I picked them up with trembling hands. Mm. And I have to say, I was very favorably impressed and surprised at how convincing it seemed.
And the reviewers pretty much in line with you this time. No guts for garters on this one. Let's go to New Haven, Connecticut, and David. David, you're on the air with Martin Amos.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious how Mr. Amos sees how his writing style has changed since he started writing novels.
I wonder if it has that much. I think it's a bit more restrained, and a loss of manic energy and a gain in decorum, really. But it's the process has been unchanged for me. I want a style is not something that you just add to everyday observations. It's style is inherent in your perceptions, and I want to describe these perceptions as exactly as I can. But so what I do is I say the sentence in my head again and again until it sounds right, and that is what I do all day, and that's what I've always done all day.
You've had the blessing and the curse of a famous literary father, Kingsley Amis. If I've got it right, he once complained that your writing was sort of too vivid, sort of showboating. Does Dad still sit on your shoulder? You're no kid anymore.
Well, he said there should be more sentences in my stuff that are like he finished his drink and left. And my reply was maybe, but there should be fewer sentences like that in your stuff. And we agreed to differ.
There you go. David's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Amis,
that's
a wonderful book. Do you see any parallels with the Gulag and the American experience with the McCarthy era?
Yeah. Also the Prohibition era. You know, America is not immune to a kind of national neurosis, and human beings are tremendously susceptible to these witch hunts and these unrealistic restrictions. It is a kind of contagion, and if you put people against people, you know, it doesn't need much of a nudge, especially if you have an ideology. Because ideology always leads to violence, you know, religion included, because it involves, all ideologies involve a bit of illusion. Clearly they do, because there's no one belief system that's going to answer every question. So when this ideology is challenged or affronted, it can't defend itself with work of mind alone, so the fists inevitably tighten. You know, you can't say, there is a God. And I'll tell you why. You can't do that, so all you can do is fight.
You're right in the thick of it in the UK nearly always. I'm reading here in The Independent just from a few days ago. They set you up for an email exchange with all comers, and the questions came thick and fast, and they're not all kind, but lots of pointed stuff in here. The very first one was a question that came to you from Edinburgh. Martin Amis, are you an Islamophobe? Let us ask it.
To which I replied, no, what I am is an Islamismophobe. And even that isn't quite right. Anti-Islamist is right, because a phobia is an irrational fear, and it is not irrational to fear a creedal wave that has said many times that it wants to kill you. Islamophobia, as it's now manifesting itself in England, and don't forget that our July the 7th, unlike your September the 11th, was the work of Englishmen, or not outside forces.
And eight arrested today in an anti-terror sweep, the British police said, young men who were, or men who planned to kidnap a young man and carry out an Iraq-style execution. Sounds pretty gruesome.
Yeah, and these are guys with, you know, northern accents, regional accents, the form it's taking at the moment is the harassment of women in the street who are wearing the veil. Now that appalls me. It's horrible to be part of a society where one group is feeling pointed at and singled out and vulnerable. On the other hand, you know, no society on earth could frictionlessly absorb a day like July the 7th.
Here's a question that came to you from Beatrice in your email exchange. Martin Amis, why are you such a snob? A word much more freighted in the UK than here, though freighted here, but more so there.
Yeah. Well, a snob is someone who has an exaggerated respect for those above him and contempt for those below him. I've been very scurrilous about such institutions as the royal family. And as for the supposed inferiors, I've spent, you know, hundreds of pages in their company. And funnily enough, you can only write about what you love, even, you know, the people you love. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the energy to set it down. So I reject that characterization.
And yet you call for a kind of new snobism, if I remember your phrase.
Yeah, I think snobbery should make a comeback.
You
know,
sometimes, what do you mean?
Sometimes it's forced on you. But it wouldn't be the old class stuff. It would be, you know, mental snobbery in the sense of exaggerated respect for rationality, and also verbal snobbery in that I urge everyone to purge their vocabularies of those, you know, communal phrases that people use, like no-brainer, I don't think so.
Out with all the clichés, please.
Well, they're sort of not even clichés. They're sort of things that are in the water for a couple of weeks, and then they're gone. You know, he went ballistic. You know, all credit to whoever coined them.
But first time.
But don't use them yourself.
And what about this UK-US relationship? You've spent a lot of time in the United States. It's been a pretty wild patch in the last few years.
It has. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that it's the only interesting thing about British politics is the extent to which we're along with America. I mean, everything else is very trivial in England because...
What do you mean by that, the extent to which you're along with America?
Well, then it's interesting because it's, you know, Iraq and the war on terror and the great issues of our day. Without our identification with America, which has been the case since Churchill, things would be as trivial as they are.
But is it still there? We sometimes hear what sounds like a gulf opening up as big as the ocean.
Among the populace, there's rampant anti-Americanism in England now, and anti-Semitism, too. That's the form it's taking. They talk about Islamophobia, but it's pushing in another direction. Anyone who's got dark skin has a, you know, huge moral start in with the English right-thinking, you know, the Guardian reading, a certain stratum of the left, is you know, viciously anti-American and anti-Semitic.
Where does that go?
Where does it go, or where does it come from?
Where does it go?
It goes into delegitimizing the state of Israel. They talk as if Israel doesn't have a right to exist. All the sympathy is with the Palestinian side, and they're apologists for Islamism. I was on a TV show the other day where a woman said, in a voice trembling with self-righteousness, said that in response, since America backed Osama bin Laden when he was fighting the Russians, its response to September the 11th should be to drop bombs on itself. And the audience applauded.
Lots of grist for the mill there. No doubt we'll read about it one way or another. Martin Amis's new novel is House of Meetings. It's been terrific to sit and have a conversation with you. Thanks so much for being here. Good luck with the book, Martin Amis.
Thank you.
We say a big goodbye today at On Point. 5.5 years ago, this show was born in the chaotic aftermath of 9/11. We've been blessed with remarkable continuity in our staff. At the heart of that has been our terrific senior producer, Graham Griffith. After many years and many great shows, after tough times and unforgettable, marvelous times, today is Graham's last with us. We know he'll never be far, certainly from our hearts. We wish him all the luck in the world. Lucky for all of us, he leaves behind a team of producers that define excellence in public radio, and that, too, is a tribute to Graham. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonas, Philip Martin, Thomas Martzall, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Dan Ancles and Matt Odette, our senior producer one more time is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.